From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made on the street where you live. How would you react if your neighbor hung a flag supporting a political candidate you oppose? Maybe a Trump flag, maybe a Biden flag if those exist. Even before an attempted assassination of former President Trump this past weekend, no one would have blamed you if you've said that the country feels like it's coming apart at the seams. And yet, according to political scientist James Druckmann, the perception of our political divide is far greater than the actual divide. Druckmann is the co-author of Partisan Hostility and American Democracy, Explaining Political Divisions and When They Matter. I have to say that in many ways, Druckmann's work makes me feel calmer, more sane. It's easy to think that things have never been worse, that the country is on the brink of collapse and that's inevitable, that we've never been so bitterly opposed to our own neighbors. Druckmann doesn't minimize the perils of a divided society, but he adds context to help us understand this moment. And one of his conclusions is, we are by no means resigned to the fate of a doomed democracy. It does not have to go that way. But there are significant warning signs, as Druckmann writes about. One is the rather straight line, he calls it a linear trend, that has been happening since the 1970s. In every election since the 1970s, each side says they dislike the other side a little bit more. At some point, we need to arrest that trend. Another is the erosion of the trust in institutions. 40 years ago, Republicans and Democrats felt pretty good about American institutions, and there wasn't much divide. Today, trust in institutions is very polarized. And then, most interesting to me, Druckmann keys in on moralization. That's the idea that if you want to engage in political discourse, you're going to quickly encounter people who don't just disagree with your positions, but they question your character for holding different views. As Druckmann describes it, this is exhausting to millions of Americans who are then choosing to disengage. That vast, disengaged middle opens the doors for the extremes to gain more power, even if they can't gain outright majorities. So let's talk about how we got here and where we can go next. My guest is Jamie Druckmann. Dr. Druckmann is the Martin Brewer-Anderson Professor of Political Science at the University of Rochester. Dr. Druckmann, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, I could ask you, first of all, how we arrived at this point, which we need to get to. But before even we get there, I want to ask you if you think that the attempted assassination this past weekend changes any of where we were. Are we fundamentally different this week than last week because of that event?
I think that we might be in two regards, although the upcoming weeks and months will really be more telling. In one regard, it could easily have upset the nature of the campaign and how the campaign is going to proceed. But that's something that's hard to anticipate, and we won't ever really know the counterfactual to that either. But it certainly changed the conversation in terms of the Biden camp, in terms of what they're talking about at this moment in time, and may well have kind of swamped out any possibility of him leaving the ticket if there was a possibility initially. So it may have changed the nature of the election. It also may have helped Trump's approval. I think the data are still kind of coming in, but you know, it certainly put Trump in a more humanizing light. And I think last night at the Republican convention, it was a very humanizing moment for Trump. So that's one regard in which it may have changed things. The other regard is when it comes to political violence or partisan violence, we often think about the roots or the causes of why somebody would support that or engage in that. And one of the reasons is that they engage in it in anticipation of the other side engaging it. That is, people are much more likely to be okay with or engage in what we might think of as defensive violence. That is violence because they think their opponents are going to engage in violence. And so when they see one side engage in violence, it might free up the possibility of further violence. So I think the concern amongst many commentators and political scientists at this point in time is whether there will be kind of an unraveling where you might get more and more violence. I mean, previous episodes suggest that does not necessarily happen, but it's always a chief concern when there is a violent event.
I want to talk to you a little bit about what I think is probably a recency bias that I'm sure I'm guilty of, and I think a lot of people are. It's easy to think that this is the worst it's ever been, that we've never been so divided, that we're on the knife's edge, and things were always much better until you know the recent time. And you know, I'm not saying that I have the authority to say that's true or not true, although you know, I think a lot of people would say, well, you know, violence is out of control, gun violence out of control, Shooting, and a lot of the indicators are down, 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 but people don't really want to believe that. So I feel like there's a recency bias with this idea that it's the worst it's ever been, and yet I think a lot of Americans really do feel like, at least in their lifetimes, this is the most divided it's been. How would we know that? How do you measure something like that?
That's a great question, and in terms of the recency bias, it's a really interesting way to put it. Insofar as we could talk about a recency bias of our lifetimes, or we could talk about a recency bias in American history. And if we talk about a recency bias in terms of American history, it's entirely possible, if not plausible or likely, that things were worse, you know, in the 1850s, the 1860s, leading up to the Civil War. There was an enormous amount of partisan violence, in fact, around those, around that time, that was directly partisan. And we can go through different eras of the country's history and talk about moments when it could have been worse. And certainly for some groups, it was most certainly worse for much of American history. If you weren't a landowning white male at the beginning of American history, it was a pretty miserable time. But, you know, if we talk about modern times and we kind of think about post-World War II, you know, I think, as you put it, you know, there are a large range of indicators that would suggest that we're at a pretty perilous point. And, you know, some of those, I'll give you examples of three of such indicators. One is, we might look at the people in Congress and how they are legislating and getting along and so on and so forth. And we can tell just from data over time on how they're casting their votes that they have become more polarized in their ideology. So Republicans have become much more conservative, Democrats have become somewhat more liberal, and so it's harder to reach compromise when you're further and further apart. And that's been a monotonic trend since the 1970s. Really, you've seen this divide within Congress. A second metric would be amongst the population. Whether they're more ideologically divided or not is somewhat unclear. But what we do know, what you mentioned at the top, was that there are indicators that we've come to dislike members of the other party more and more over time. Again, going back to the 1970s, they've been asking the same question, which amounts to, how much do you like or dislike members of the other party? And every year there's more and more dislike, and it's never bumped up. And so that's a pretty clear indicator right there. And then a final indicator would be, there are a host of international entities and some domestic entities that rate the quality of democracy. And by most of those metrics, the American democracy has certainly dropped, and kind of the score on any democratic metric has gone down in the last 10 years. And so that, you know, those are all concerning signs for sure, and something that we should be conscious of, and I think have shaped the conversations that have been going on about the state of American democracy.
Well, the question of when things really changed is interesting, because I think a lot of American, I'm going to say conservatives, although I don't know if conservatives and Republicans are the same thing anymore, but I think people on the political right sometimes idealize the 1950s, for example. And you've keyed in on a change in political rhetoric that really started in the 1990s especially. And that appears to coincide to me with the expansion of more broadcast outlets, more voices out there, more profitability to sort of to be extreme, talk, commercial talk radio, et cetera. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think there are many moments that we could talk about, and kind of many, many factors that played into things. I mean, to just step back for a moment, I won't go into too far into these things, but I think we could talk about political changes and how the parties have changed over time. And that's a longer term trajectory that's gone on. We can talk about societal changes that have gone on in the 21st century and how that's affected things. And then we can talk about political changes specifically. And I think that you're exactly right. If we talk about political changes specifically, and kind of how our politics have changed, and then how that kind of looped back and then affected the way people behave in the political sphere, the 1990s was a pretty crucial point. And it's hard to think about what caused what, but you certainly saw in the mid-1990s, you know, Newt Gingrich is often pointed to as somebody who changed the way that politics operate insofar as using a lot more we versus they language and win-loss language, and that became more of a common narrative that we see. And, you know, well beyond Newt Gingrich, we can kind of see in Congress, members of Congress started invoking partisanship at a much higher rate than they had previously. And so things got a little bit more tense in that respect. And then, of course, you know, of equal, if not probably greater importance, was a massive technological change. And when we talk about technological change, we can talk about the beginning of cable television, then we can kind of go into partisan media outlets, and then we can go into the internet, and then of course social media. And the rate at which those things have profused is just so remarkable, yet certainly changed the way that we think about politics. I mean, if you go back to the turn of the century in 2000 or 2002, you know, it's quite amusing. If you look at a candidate website, you know, it's basically one page and, you know, maybe a contact information. And to think about what's going on now with kind of social media outlets, you know, it's a completely different communication world than it was at that point in time. So that's certainly been a factor in how practice of politics occurs today.
And I just want to also key in a little bit more on the subject of political violence. It's obviously on the on a lot of people's minds recently. And I didn't realize until just kind of the last few days, kind of going back over recent stories of political violence, that it was just a few weeks ago that David DePape was sentenced to 30 years in prison and 5 years of supervised release for the conviction that he had after he broke into Nancy Pelosi's home, and he wanted to hold her hostage. She was not there. He attacked and bludgeoned with a hammer Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, who required surgery for a fractured skull. And Donald Trump, even a year later, was saying at state GOP conventions and rallies that there was no terror at all, no terrorism during the Trump presidency, although the only terror was Nancy Pelosi, and everyone booed. And then Trump kind of said jovially, "Hey, how's her husband doing anyway?" And everyone kind of laughed and cheered. And, you know, that is laughing at an assassination attempt and political violence. And now we're told that, well, you know, I mean, he is the victim here. And how dare anybody, say that he could have sparked it. I mean, it's clearly Joe Biden who sparked it. Lester Holt on NBC News is asking Joe Biden if he regrets using the word put a target on Donald Trump. So I just bring this up to say that the recent years have not been all that clean when it comes to recognizing the threat of political violence, Donald Trump included. And I want to know from you if you think that is, again, unique to history, or if that's sort of a continual charging up of the rhetoric, how you see it.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, as I mentioned before, the extent, I guess, first let's distinguish political violence and partisan violence. And political violence is a much broader term and can involve state use of violence or non-state entities engaging in violence. I think the concern, right, not to minimize the concern about general political violence, but I think a lot of what we're talking about is partisan violence, where a given partisan side is engaging in violence for the promotion of their side. And to the extent, you know, has that gone up or down? You know, I think, again, historically, we don't have a great sense over the long arch of American history. There is some historians who would say there was as I mentioned earlier, there was a substantial amount of partisan directed violence during or preceding the Civil War. But certainly in modern times, since people have been trying to chart these things, the rate at which there has been ostensible partisan violence has certainly gone up. I want to kind of add two caveats to that, though, the two caveats are, one, it's certainly gone up and the number of threats have certainly gone up, and it's extremely concerning. You know, they have really palatable consequences for obviously those involved and kind of the general country and society. But the rate of actual violence are still relatively low. There's still, you know, I think from 2020, since January 6th, for about the next 2 years, or maybe 200 cases of what people would characterize as partisan violence. So certainly not trivial, but also not massive. So I think it's important to put that in some context. That said, you know, as I mentioned, it that is higher than what anybody had previously seen. And I think that there is, kind of coming back to your question, I think the development of allowing candidates and politicians and other actors to directly communicate with one another and to citizens has certainly raised the possibility that they are could incite violence in ways that they couldn't previously do so, right? Before there was access to social media, more or less, even if you were president, there was usually a mediator between you and what you could say. That you were reliant on the media to put you on television or to report on you, but now you can directly speak to citizens without a mediator in between. And there certainly is concern, you know, when we think about partisan violence, I previously mentioned perception of the other side, and that's part of it. The other two parts of it are general things that lead to more violent behavior, are when you dehumanize the other side, people are much more likely to engage in violence if they view the other side as less than human. And they're also much more likely to engage in violence if they crave some kind of a chaos. You know, psychologists refer to this as a need for chaos. And when you have those two things going on, and those two things might be invoked in rhetoric, it certainly increases the possibility of violence.
So what really is the going to determine how we go forward? And by that, I mean, I'm not asking you to predict the future. I mean, I think Derek Thompson wrote a really good piece today saying that don't listen to anyone who tells you they know what the future holds, and not even in this coming election. I mean, a lot of people feel like, you know, something is set in stone. And Thompson just said we should learn important lessons from history, that there's so much that could change in the next 3 to 4 months. So I'm not asking you to predict the future. I am asking you if we are not at a point where the polarization in actuality is as intense as it might feel to people. I think my fear is that we could become actually that divided. I'm fearful that we could have gotten there this weekend if Trump had died. And and I'm curious to know, going forward, what would be that fork in the road that sends us on one path or another? What does history tell us?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wish I had a more optimistic answer than I'm going to offer. I think first, let me elaborate a little bit on the reality versus perceptions of polarization.
When I
kind of earlier said, you know, I went through those metrics of things that have increased over time, and one of them was these measures of how much citizens one partisan side dislikes the other partisan side at an increasing rate. That's a reality. I mean, that's not a perception. And so, right, this specifically, for example, on that scale, you might rate somebody, how much do I as a Republican dislike a Democrat? And, you know, 0 being I really hate them and 100 being I really love them. And that score has dropped. So most recently, it's kind of gravitated around 20. And that's a real change. So that's real. What's perceived, though, is that even though that's gotten very low, people actually perceive it to be at about 0. And so the perception is that it's greater than it is. And I think what we have seen over time is not entirely, it's not just, you know, all self-fulfilling prophecy, but perceptions do become a reality at some point. And, you know, going back to our discussion of violence earlier, that's the concern, that perceptions that the other side is more extreme than they actually are becomes a reality. And that's certainly a cycle that we are worried about, that we're being on. You know, what could kind of temper these trends that we've kind of seen in the things that I discussed earlier? It's an interesting question insofar as what we had seen through the 21st century. Earlier in the 21st century, there were certain moments in time that seemed to bring the country more together. 9/11 being the most prominent of those, but also if you look at when Osama bin Laden was killed, that definitely tempered things. You know, most of the surveys that were being done at that time, suddenly there was a much more sense of American unity and a kind of a tempering of partisan animosity at that point in time. And so I'm mentioning that because, you know, when it comes to COVID, when COVID first hit, I think there was some sense among some that that might bring the country together. And obviously it did not do that in any sense. And so I think that was a concerning sign insofar as we had an event where we were all at risk and all facing a common concern. And you know, it's a really worrisome situation. And the country just ostensibly became much more divided because of that. And moreover, not only did it become more divided, but some of the institutions, I appreciate that at the outset you mentioned the decline in trust in institutions. Not only has there been a decline in trust, but perhaps more concerning is that there's been an increase in polarization around institutions. And so, right, if you go back to the 1970s, and when I say institutions, I'm talking a lot about non-political institutions or non-partisan institutions.
Mm-hmm, right.
For example, like science or religion or media.
Public health.
Public health, yes. And so what we've seen is that over time, you know, pick your institution, and it used to be that there would be pretty much overlap. You know, your partisanship was not a great predictor of whether or not you had a great deal of confidence in a given institution. And that's really changed, and COVID contributed to some of that change. We see that particularly with science, where there's an enormous polarization in trust in science. And so you kind of see these moments that you think will bring people together don't do that, and then they actually have a negative externality, so to speak, in making other institutions that help govern and kind of situate society become more divided. People become more divided about them. And so that's kind of the downside of things. I think we can ask kind of, well, what's an upside of thing? And so, to be a little bit more positive in what could help, I do think that there are some really well-meaning actors out there. I think there are well-meaning elites that are trying to do bipartisan things together. And so I think, you know, that's an important thing. The more that elites can operate in correspondence with one another, that's a very helpful thing to do. It's a little bit hard to imagine, but we are in the middle of an election campaign. So it should be unimaginable in an election campaign. But, you know, the hope is that you can get a little bit more bipartisan agreement on stuff. You know, that's at least relatively. And then, you know, the other hope is that we can try to situate our perceptions of one another a little bit better and not moralize as much. You know, how we go about doing that is difficult. You know, I think there's a lot of energy in civic society to work on these things. How you scale that up is a challenge.
Oh, there are so many places I want to take this conversation, and I also want to leave plenty of space for listeners who are calling and emailing the program. We're talking to Dr. James Druckmann, who is the Martin Brewer Anderson Professor of Political Science at the University of Rochester, the co-author of the new book, Partisan Hostility in American Democracy, Explaining Political Divisions and When They Matter. Listeners, if you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. So let me just squeeze in a few more of the questions that are on my long list, and then I will cede the stage to the listeners who will probably have a lot to say. But you just mentioned elites, and this is something that I think is very interesting lately. It is, you know, humorous in sort of this dark way to me to see people who are clearly elites blaming elites or complaining about elites. Donald Trump complains about elites all the time. Joe Biden has taken to blaming the elites for trying to push him out of the race. I believe that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the definition of elites, but maybe you see it differently, Dr. Druckmann.
No, I mean, it's actually quite fascinating. They're the definition of elites, but also mirror images or contrasts with one another, right? Biden is probably the most insider political person nearly in the history of the country, given that he's held federal office for, you know, near more than 50 years, which is probably more than anybody else ever has. And so, you know, in that sense, he is part of the political establishment in ways that may be unprecedented. And then on Trump, he was certainly not part of the political elite when he entered politics. He was, in fact, the first president ever elected who had not held prior political office or military office. But he was certainly part of the economic elite. And so, and part of that system, to say the least, that's why everybody knew of him, of course. And, you know, he is, with the evolution of the Republican Party since he took office, has certainly become part of the political elite. And so it is quite interesting to see those conversations. And you see it on both sides, as you mentioned. And, you know, not just with Trump and Biden, but certainly their surrogates as well. You see, you know, this increasing conversations of blaming elites. And, you know, I think that reflects the populist bent that's kind of gone on in the U.S. and more broadly around the world. There's certainly a increase in populist attitudes, and so I think that is reflects that. And you know, along those lines too, you see Biden, which has been interesting to me, you know, kind of selectively choosing which polls and dismissing the experts who do polls more recently. And so, you know, again, you see that on both sides. And you know, Trump is kind of infamous for his dismissal of elites or of expertise.
One of the things that I think is going to make it harder for us to bring down the animus that we feel for one another as citizens, or even arrest this trend that you've talked about of since the 1970s, every election, one side sees the other, you know, dislikes the other more and more and more. And that is the fact that we are increasingly not even living near people who disagree with us. I've seen pretty good data, although I would love to see it updated. But in 1976, Jimmy Carter gets elected. The amount of American landslide counties was around 25%. That's a county where one candidate wins by 20 points or more over the other. So 25% landslide counties in 1976. 40 years later, Donald Trump gets elected. It's 61% landslide counties. Means yeah. You are less and less likely to even have neighbors who disagree with you. And by now, we're around 70% landslide counties and more than 20% super landslide with 40-point majorities. And so, I mean, if you are only around people of the same mind, like mine, we know that, you know, I mean, like there's interesting experiments where three people can get on an elevator, and if they all disagree, they'll get off the elevator, you know, understanding one another a little bit better. But if they all agree, they'll get off. By the time they get off the elevator, their own positions are more extreme. So I see that trend, and I think, well, what's going to convince people to choose to live among people who think differently? We've been going in a bad direction on that since the 1970s.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's really interesting data. I haven't seen those exact statistics, but it's consistent with related data that I've seen in kind of the overtime evolution of kind of political echo chambers and where we live. And I think there's a few points here. One point is simply even if people aren't, it's not clear how much people are choosing explicitly to live in a certain place for political reasons or not. It's an interesting question, given some of the changes in abortion law, for example, if people are doing that at a higher rate than they had before. But regardless of what the reason for their choice is, just the kind of the demographic sorting of the parties, where you have religious people moving into the Republican Party and higher educated people moving into the Democratic Party and rural people moving into the Republican Party, is just by consequence, regardless of the reasons they're making those choices, is dividing us. And so we end up with this country where we have very segregated communities and segregated states. And I think that's one of the things, one of the concerns that I think longer term post the 2024 election is that we increasingly have states that look so unlike one another that it becomes a very disunified country, particularly if the federal government continues to delegate more and more. And I'm thinking specifically about education. And, you know, education is the place where historically, education is supposed to be in part to provide people with a civic education and make them active citizens in American democracy. And, there's obviously have conversations about what that means, but there's obviously very different visions in different states of what that entails. And if there's no commonality in education and it's not a place where people are learning how to be open, tolerant to other perspectives, then that further separates the country, it further separates states from one another. And so I think that there's this geographic dispersion that's going on that you mentioned, and then that becomes kind of infused into the institutions. And, you know, particularly concerning to me is into the educational institutions. And, you know, what that then presents for later generations is worrisome.
How does that manifest in education?
You know, I think the most obvious example would be how you teach about race and kind of how various states have put on different laws about what you are and are not able to talk about in terms of race, also in terms of gender. And, you know, that generates different types of perceptions of people who are unlike yourself. And so, you know, you might not have explicit laws about whether you can teach about conservative or liberal ideology, but you certainly have laws that ensure that you can talk about different groups in specific ways. And actually, as I said, that you laws are liberal or conservative ideology. You do have laws for universities in certain states where there is a requirement that you have ideological diversity in the classroom. I mean, that's another conversation one could have. But, you know, you are, it's again, a difference that you're seeing in some states and not others in how education is being overseen.
All right, listeners, one more question from me, and then we've got a bunch lined up here. But I wanted to ask Dr. Druckmann, again, who's the author of Partisan Hostility in American Democracy, Explaining Political Divisions and When They Matter. He's the co-author of that new book. I wanted to ask about a subject that is important here in his work, which is moralization. And that stands out to me because, you know, in 11 years of hosting this talk show, I have observed, I would certainly endorse what you are writing about and what you are sort of raising here, which is that when people feel like they cannot enter or engage in political discourse without being sort of immediately judged, not just for the quality of their ideas, but their characters on the line and how they're sort of viewed by neighbors and friends and family, and that people will naturally just pull away from that. And even if the vast middle of the country is bigger in population than the extremes will gain more power because they're the ones who don't care. They're going to go to a sort of this social culture war, and they don't care about getting called a bad person. They want the power that comes with engaging, and a lot of the people in the middle just feel left out or just exhausted by it. And I want you to talk about how, like, why that happens or what has driven that, and then if you see any antidote to that.
Yeah, I think two things have driven that somewhat. And one of those things is just the type of themes that we've been talking about insofar as the parties have become further and further apart. They're made up of different demographic groups that look more and more different from one another. And so what that means is that you can, in some sense, think of the parties as mega identities. Insofar as when you think of a Democrat, you think of people with a certain demographic background in terms of religiosity or education or urban, rural or class or race. And so that becomes a cue that it kind of encompasses one's many other elements of a person. And so in that sense, when a Democrat thinks of a Republican or a Republican thinks of a Democrat, it's more than just, oh, that person has a liberal or liberal or conservative ideology, but rather that person is different from me on all kinds of characteristics. And the more different someone is from you, the less likely you are to see their perspective and the more likely you might be to judge them. And so in that sense, partisanship has become an entity that is something that one starts to moralize people who are not from your party. Kind of alongside with that is this expansion of politics into different domains of life. You know, if we go back, and it's connected to what I just spoke about, but if we go back to the 1960s or 1970s, they used to ask these questions. And I actually think there's been some objective data on this as well about, for example, how likely or how upset would you be if a child of yours married somebody from the other party? And, you know, people weren't celebrating that, all else constant, but they weren't particularly bothered by that. And today, you know, they're really bothered by that. And so it's kind of crept into social life in that sense. We think about politics in the workplace in ways that we didn't used to. And it's crept into institutions, as I spoke about earlier, right? When we talk about science or public health or religion, it becomes part of our politics. And so for all those reasons, we kind of see the tendency to moralize because we see groups that are different from us when we talk about politics, more different than we used to think. And we see politics encroaching on different domains of our lives. And so the spread of politics and the homogenization of the parties in that sense have probably facilitated people moralizing one another. And then the great exacerbator of all of this is media and social media in particular. What we do know is that moralized content on social media spreads much more quickly than non-moralized content. And so people, you know, they retweet, they share things that are moralizing much more quickly than they do, you know, things of equal content, but not moralizing. And so, you know, there seems to be some appetite for moralization. And as you said, people don't like to be moralized. It's off-putting and they kind of back out. And so I think one thing that you have seen is that as you've seen kind of the rise of polarization, you kind of see this rise of engaged people who are very polarized, but at the same time, you see this huge dropout of people who, as you said, are more in the middle and might be a bit more moderate, and they just want to disengage from politics. They don't want to talk about politics in the workplace. They certainly don't want to talk about it at the dinner table. And, you know, disengagement, we shouldn't necessarily require that people are always politically engaged, but if they're disengaging because politics has become so toxic, that's not a good sign. And you know, that's not a good outcome. It could decrease, I mean, we haven't seen a decline in voting, but, you know, it could decrease the likelihood of voting turnout and other things in it. But you know, perhaps most concerning is basically what you said, is that it allows extremes on each side to have more power over the discourse and potentially over the political outcomes.
And then all of a sudden we think everything is more extreme than perhaps it is, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that moralization point about moralized rhetoric spreading more quickly, you know, then you get the impression that everybody on the other side is going to moralize you. So one of the really interesting things that I heard some people talk about near me with the assassination attempt was that, oh, they kind of saw the people who had not been very familiar necessarily with Trump supporters, they saw people from the rally being interviewed, Trump supporters, and the reaction was, oh, wow, they seem like regular people. You know, there's this kind of an image in one's head of something that's not real. And so, you know, that kind of comes back to the geographic separation, but then also kind of the pictures that we're getting from media, social media.
Yeah, I would recommend listeners listen to what Governor Shapiro of Pennsylvania, by the way, University of Rochester graduate, Governor Josh Shapiro, what he said about the man who was killed in that rally. You know, a big supporter of Donald Trump, and the governor is a Democrat, but the way he spoke about that man, I think, is a good model for how we ought to be thinking about each other and how we contextualize someone's life. So if you haven't heard that, I would recommend listeners would go check that out. Let me get some phone calls here. Rich in Rochester has been waiting. Hello, Rich, go ahead.
Hello, Evan, how are you doing?
Good, sir.
The interesting thing about what happened with COVID that was the first time, and I haven't been around for 1,000 years, but I actually saw the leader of the institutions doing everything to denigrate the institution and make them invalid. There seemed to be this, that anti-science, that anti-expert, if it didn't fit into a political spectrum, I've never seen it at to that level on a medical emergency in a national emergency. Usually what everybody does is galvanize around those institutions. But the exact opposite happened this time. And that was just crazy to me.
And Rich, what do you attribute that to?
I attribute it to Trump's demagoguery, and that being more important to him than anything else. I don't think even in the shooting, it doesn't seem like he seems to value people. I mean, he hasn't, example, he hasn't called the lady of his supporter who was killed. He hasn't called her. I find this all strange.
Yeah. And part of what Rich is referring to is, reporting yesterday that Donald Trump on Sunday played golf and did not call the family of the man who died. Joe Biden did call. President Biden called that family. The widow told reporters that as a devout Republican, she did not want to take that call, but she doesn't have anything personally against President Biden. I've never heard that term, devout Republican, until that comment, but so it goes. Anything you want to add there, Dr. Druckmann?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's a great insight into kind of the evolution of COVID. And the interesting thing about COVID are two elements following up on Rich's comment and question is you did see kind of over the course of the pandemic, things changed quite substantially. So if you looked early in the pandemic before things got, there was a moment in time, which a lot of us might forget, where things were not nearly as politicized as they became. And you didn't really see much partisan divide when it came to what people thought of the CDC or the FDA or even Fauci. But kind of as the pandemic went along, you obviously saw this enormous divide emerge. One interesting thing, though, is that in the book that Evan has mentioned, we do find during COVID that Democrats obviously were much more likely to get vaccinated, much more likely to follow social distancing regulations and so on and so forth. But you do see Republicans in high COVID outreach areas or people who are vulnerable to COVID were much more likely than otherwise to do so. So there are situations when personal well-being is directly under threat where people do seem to put partisanship aside. It just seems that those situations are rather severe.
Mm-hmm. Rich, thank you. I have a question from a listener named Art, and I think this is really a smart question for Dr. Druckmann. Art says, I'm currently reading Eric Larson's book, Demon of Unrest, about the start of the Civil War. At that time, the country was very divided about something very concrete, ending slavery, preserving the Union. What would a Civil War be fought over today? Ideology? This question might be naive, but I truly don't know. That's from Art. I actually think the question is telling, Dr. Druckmann.
Yeah, that's a really great question. That's something to really reflect upon. I think the people who have spoken about the possibility of a civil war, often kind of come back to kind of racial divisions today in the country. Whether those are sufficient at this point in time to generate a civil war and overlap enough with the partisan divides are unclear. But it is, I don't have a great answer to that other than that I did find it interesting that one of the responses after the assassination among some of the Republicans, J.D. Vance, I think probably got the most coverage for this, of kind of blaming Democrats. And the characterization was that Democrats were to blame because they talk about Trump as being anti-democratic. And I thought that was interesting insofar as I don't know, does that mean that there would be a civil war over whether or not we have a democratic country or not, but I'm not sure we all agree on what that necessarily even means. And whether that's off the table for talking about in politics seemed a little bit odd or kind of an interesting invocation to me, relative to the kind of, it's certainly not a direct dehumanizing statement. So I thought that was interesting, but it's a great question.
Mary writes to say, by the way, Art, the reason I think that question is so good is it reveals, I think, how absurd it would be for a country like this in this moment in time. With all of the problems that we have, this is a country doing very well in many regards. To have a civil war would be absurd. And you're right, Art. There's nothing that is obvious that stands out that we would be doing that over, except for this idea of polarization that I, from based on this book, we could get to, but we're not at right now. That's what gives me some comfort. Mary writes to say, Evan, a correction for you. Joe Biden did not say put a target on Trump. Biden corrected Lester Holt, saying what he really said was we have to put Trump in the bullseye and focus on what he says and his policies. Yeah, Mary, I agree with you. I raise that as an example of how people are using this moment to score points that are, I don't think, are very helpful. We use battlefield analogies in sports. We use it in politics. I don't think Joe Biden had to apologize for saying we should put Trump in the bullseye and focus on what he says and his policies. It's obvious what he's saying is he thinks there's too much focus on his own age and cognitive decline, and he thinks the focus of the election should be on Trump because Trump poses the bigger threat to the Republic. That's Biden's point. It's a fair one if he wants to make it. Trump could make the same point about Biden. He could use the same rhetoric. It doesn't mean he wants people to shoot the guy. It's much more dangerous when people joke about actual violence that has happened. I referenced Trump laughing at Paul Pelosi nearly getting killed with a hammer. The guy who shot Steve Scalise was, you know, an ardent left winger who was angry at Trump and angry at Republicans. That's terrible. We should not be doing that. But I don't think, I don't know, Dr. Druckmann, I mean, I don't love battlefield analogies, but I don't think that's the reason people pick up guns and shoot politicians.
No, I don't think so either. I suppose the term target kind of suggests something, a shooting analogy of sorts, I suppose. And so that is perhaps why that ended up getting a fair amount of discussion. But yeah, I think the bigger concern would be when people, you know, incite things directly, as we've seen, or, you know, as I mentioned before, engage in something that may dehumanize another side. I think that's where, you know, we can really get rhetorical effects on inclinations for violent behavior.
Dan in Rochester on the phone next, I think. Hello, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Sure, go ahead.
So I was wondering, you made a comment just recently about a person identifying as a devout Republican and thinking about like how our identities inform our devotion to our political party. So like, I'm a teacher and that is a strong part of my identity, but it's only a part of my identity. And I'm wondering, like, with people being on social media, so their own identity being broadcast out to the world, with people's jobs maybe being more or less satisfying or being able to identify more or less with their careers, with religion becoming less of a factor and less of a part of people's identities, you might be able to say than the past. Does all of the do these factors feed into, well, they're just being a part of a person's identity that becomes amplified because these other aspects of people's identities becoming less important to Americans? I'll take your commentary offline.
Okay, thank you, Dan. What do you think, Dr. Druckmann?
Wonderfully put statement, comment, or question. I think when at the end of the day, I think most of us probably, if we were to kind of rate the importance of different identities, partisanship might not be that highly rated, which is perhaps why hearing somebody say they're a devout, in that case, Republican, is interesting. Because we it's not language we would hear, but we would, if they said I'm a devout Christian, that would not be a surprising thing to have said, right? Because we think of religion or race or gender, those might be identities that might be more fundamental to somebody's perceptions of themselves. And so what is going on with partisanship? How could it be at once an identity that might not be really so central to one's self-image, but yet so consequential for how our society seems to be operating. And I think, again, part of it is basically it has become what I referenced before as, in a way, a mega identity that envelops all kinds of other identities. And so it sums up who we are, both in terms of kind of descriptive characteristics, but also in terms of our belief systems somewhat. And so in that sense, it's kind of an aggregator, and the other side is aggregated in a very different direction. And so I do think that there is some interesting interplay between the identities that we have that are near and dear to us that we use to define ourselves. And of course, there are exceptions, obviously, where people might think of themselves, their partisan identity as fundamental, but I think on average, it's not. But I think the conflation of these different demographic and belief systems that we have seen kind of sort over the last several decades have led partisanship to have the appearance of being a much more salient identity.
All right, let me get Michael and Jane on the phone. Michael in Geneva, listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio WEOS. Hello, Michael.
Hello, thank you for the wonderful show. My question is, I think the speaker's done a wonderful job of talking about we need to take the tone down, we need to see people as people and not their political party, but I have a tough time understanding how we move forward with trying to humanize people. But when we look at radicalization and we look at changing curriculum in schools to fit your political narrative, when we think of not dealing with gun violence, when we think of political violence, the MAGA movement is doing all this stuff. And just to back up a quick second, I'm an independent. My family is all for Trump. But when one side, in my opinion, is acting as a bad actor, how do we walk this line of being like, we want to humanize people, we want to be fair. But when you look at, once again, changing history in schools, not dealing with gun violence, demonizing migrants, how do you have that conversation while humanizing them, but also not, you can't compare apples and oranges and say, oh, well, the extreme left wants to fight for the environment or they want to include everyone. How do you walk that line? How do we not ignore who's actually being extreme, who's trying to change history, but also bring people together?
I will let Dr. Druckmann address that. Go ahead, Dr. Druckmann.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy question to answer. I think one thing is to draw a distinction between citizens and political professionals or elites. And, I certainly don't want to downgrade the concerns that you raised. I think they're very serious concerns that are a threat to society and democracy for sure. I think one way to humanize it, though, is to try to get people to think about there are kind of elites who say certain things and they have a lot of influence. And that might be something we should worry a lot about and be kind of taking action to address to the extent we can, by voting, by doing other civic activities. But then there is kind of the rest of the population, and the rest of the population, at least in this coming election, we're basically given two choices. And the polling I've seen suggests that most people aren't too thrilled with either of those choices. And so there are kind of these questions of that leads to kind of a meta question of what's going on with the institutions of this country. And that's a conversation one could have, but it's very hard to change any of these institutions, obviously. But it also leads to the insight that, the people on average are not necessarily the epitome of what we're seeing at the elite level. And so, coming back to kind of what Evan said earlier, we have two candidates who are also kind of the epitome of insiders in some sense. And so kind of, I think drawing that distinction is an important one to have. And then also just, again, there are lots of groups out there in civic society who are trying to do things to improve the interaction between different sides. And, the more mileage that those groups can get, the better it is.
Michael, I would also just say that try to remember that citizens who have a different view than you do. So if you're a Trump voter and you can't stand the Biden voter two doors down, or if you are a Democrat and you can't believe someone's hanging a Trump flag, just remember that most people are not going to bed at night thinking that they are a bad person and they got away with it. They really believe they're on the right side of history. And I know that it could be hard to believe at times that people do believe that. But they do. People are not, just sort of nefariously going throughout their day just laughing about how bad they are and getting away with it. For whatever reason, their beliefs that might be different than yours have been formed intellectually, honestly to them. And treating people as if they know they're bad and they're evil and they should be treated that way is a good way of getting through to nobody. I am sorry if you've emailed, if you're on the phone and I didn't get to you. Dr. Druckmann has really lit up the phones and the emails today. He's the co-author of Partisan Hostility in American Democracy, Explaining Political Divisions and When They Matter. And I will give you 45 seconds to close. What do you want to leave with listeners, Dr. Druckmann?
Yeah, well, thank you so much again for having me. And thank you for the great questions that came up. And I guess the last comment I'll have is that there is a lot of conversation in this election about democracy or not democracy. And I guess one thing that I would emphasize is to not create a binary out of that. And so I think that the last caller raised a lot of issues which might undermine the quality of our democracy. Whether those undermine the functioning of the democracy generally is less clear. And so I think there are just more nuanced conversations to be had about kind of this gray area of we might be not as democratic or not operating as much as we would like, but that doesn't mean necessarily that we've completely jumped over into an authoritarian situation. Not to understate the threat of that possibility, though.
I appreciate the time, Dr. Druckmann. Thank you for making it for us. And unfortunately, I think we're going to need you again to keep these conversations going. Thank you for being generous with your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Jamie Druckmann is the Martin Brewer Anderson Professor of Political Science at the University of Rochester. And you can pick up his new book. He's the co-author of Partisan Hostility in American Democracy, Explaining Political Divisions and When They Matter. More connections coming up in just a moment.